Chapter 1. On the 1st of February 1887, boat named Lady Vane sank with no known survivors. There was a private gentleman on the boat. He was my uncle, and his name was Edward Prendick. The news of his death hit me terribly because I was only young at the time. You can imagine my shock when, almost a year later, on the 5th of January 1888, to be exact, my uncle was found floating in a small dinghy in a similar place to where the Lady Vane had gone down. These are the facts of the matter. After his rescue, my uncle tried to describe his experience and explain what had happened during the 11 months he had been missing. Few believed his tale and even went so far as to say that he had gone mad from the trauma he had experienced. As such, he took back his story and hardly mentioned it again, to my knowledge. But now the years have gone by, and my uncle has died. Recently, I came into an inheritance of his possessions, which included a diary of interest. The story on these pages is hard to believe. It seems more like a work of fiction, but there are other facts I've since discovered that back up his tale. It is also true that in 1887, a ship called the Ipecacuanha left Africa with a number of animals on board, including a puma and some smaller beasts. Their captain, John Davies, was known for being an alcoholic, and it was easy to find references to this journey. Finding Ipecacuanha in the waters near where my uncle says he was rescued supports his story. There is also some evidence of an island in the location my uncle hints at. However, I can't find any proof of the animals he mentions. I provide this introduction so you can make up your mind about the story my uncle is sharing and the strange island of Dr. Moreau. Charles Edward Prendick, nephew of Edward Prendick. There isn't much I can add to what is known of the fate of Lady Vane, and that is not the story I am here to tell. However, it is worth mentioning that while the newspapers reported that four men escaped from the boat in a dinghy, I might as well tell you that there were only three of us. The fourth man, Constance, jumped, as the captain later said, but he never made it to the boat and died as the three of us in the dinghy floated away. So there it was, three of us, Helmar, who was a passenger on the boat like myself, and a seaman whose name I can't recall. We feared for our lives each minute, watched the horizon and prayed for rescue. There were only a few biscuits and a small amount of fresh water, which decreased day by day. "Look, it's like this," said Helmar, speaking loudly after hours of nothing but the sound of waves hitting our small boat. He had clearly been attempting to bring up this topic for quite a while. "It's like this. We've been in the boat for over a week now, right? And we can't all three of us survive much longer, can we? The biscuits are gone, and our attempts at fishing have failed. We'll starve, so we need to do something." "But what?" the seaman replied tiredly. "It's like this," Helmar said again, speaking slowly and with hesitation. "One of us must sacrifice himself for the other two. What's the point of all three of us dying? If we do nothing, the three of us will be dead in just a few days, maybe even sooner. So, this is what I propose. We should draw lots and see who the unlucky one is. Then, well, the other two will kill him and eat his flesh in order to survive." I didn't say a word. My heart was beating very fast. It was true that in doing nothing, the three of us would soon be dead, but could I approve or even become involved in something as horrifying as murder and cannibalism? What could I say to that? "What?" the seaman stammered. "What are you talking about? Look, it's the only way, right? If not, we'll all die. We need to stop it, just stop it." "This is ridiculous," the seaman sighed, then turned his body to face the other way, making the boat rock terribly from side to side. Still, I said nothing. I didn't want to draw attention to myself or side with one man or the other. Who could take life and death in their hands in such a way? Evening crept in, bringing relief from the sun and the heat. But soon, the cold and darkness swept over us. The light was gone, and all we had were the sounds of the ocean. I woke in the night to the sound of whispers and immediately feared for my life. Had Helmar convinced the seamen to forget drawing lots and kill me straight out while I slept and was unable to protect myself? Although my heart was beating fast, I kept quiet and listened carefully to discover what was happening, with my eyes tightly closed. I was relieved to find out that there was no murder plan after all. As I listened, I heard Helmar pleading with the seamen. He was telling him that when morning came, we must draw lots and carry out the plan, whoever the unlucky soul may be. The seamen didn't answer. When the sun rose over the horizon, Helmar brought it up again. "It's the only way," he said, offering the coins from his pocket to use for a game so we could decide who the loser would be. Helmar seemed confident that he wouldn't fall short, otherwise, he wouldn't suggest the plan repeatedly, would he? Reluctantly, I took the coins and nodded, agreeing to the terrible plan. What else could I do? The seamen did the same. With a bit of nervousness, Helmar, the seamen, and I opened our palms to reveal the coins. The seamen had lost. "No," he whispered angrily. Helmar said nothing but had a serious look on his face. I didn't know what to say. Bad luck seemed too casual for such a terrible situation. How do you apologize to a man who you are about to kill? I felt sick and knew that I couldn't do it. But Helmar obviously intended to carry out the plan. I could see it in his eyes. "Come on, now. You can't be serious. You're not going to," the seaman protested but stopped when he saw Helmar reach for something. Helmar and the sailor didn't know that I had a small knife hidden in my pocket. I intended to use it only if necessary, to protect myself. The seaman feared that he was about to be attacked, so he swiftly moved forward and grabbed Helmar. Even though Helmar was determined, it was evident that the sailor was the stronger of the two men. I sat as far back as I could, holding onto the boat as it rocked violently from side to side. Helmar and the sailor hit each other, and soon, they were both hurt and struggling to breathe because they were weakened from not having enough food and water. They kept wrestling, and when they fell, one of them hit his head on the side of the boat with a disturbing crack. Each had a firm G-rip-o-n-t-he-other-sea-loats-s-o together, they tumbled over the edge and plunged into the water. Everything went silent. The two men held onto each other, trying to make the other sink, and I saw them go under the water quickly. Within a moment, the ripples on the surface of the water had died away, and as I looked down into the dark depths, I could see nothing. Each second, I expected a sudden surprise and waited for one of them to suddenly come up to the surface, but there was nothing. I knew that man could not survive long without oxygen, and even if one had died and released his grip on the other, he would have to swim hard to reach the surface. After a few minutes, I knew for certain that both men were dead. I was completely alone. I remember laughing crazily, my voice cracking in the quiet of the ocean. The drinking water was gone, and it had been days since I'd had a bite to eat. I thought about catching a fish, but I didn't have any skill or any bait to attract the creatures. I sometimes thought about ending my life by drowning or drinking seawater to die quicker, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. About 2 days after my shipmates had drowned, I noticed something from the corner of my eye. It was a ship. I was so weak from hunger that I had been lying down in the dinghy, so I only saw the boat when it was right next to me. If I had been standing and thinking clearly, I would have spotted it miles away, signaled for help, and screamed for rescue to ensure they didn't pass me by. Luckily, someone on the ship had spotted my boat and come to investigate. I was feeling dizzy and confused, so I barely noticed who rescued me or the words they said while lifting me out of my floating prison. One was a man with pale yellow hair, another had a dark and curious face, something like a nightmare. But as I say, at this time, I was half crazy and almost dying of hunger. So, when these thoughts came to me days later, I couldn't make sense of them. I woke up in a small, messy cabin that was poorly lit. There was a man sitting and staring at me. He was young, with straw-colored hair and a bristly mustache. He looked at me with interest but said nothing, and nor did I. My body ached all over, and my mind was foggy. I thought I could hear strange animal noises somewhere beyond the room. It sounded like there was something in a cage, clanging around, the sound of men grumbling, and the creature being beaten, but these were just thoughts in my mind, and I couldn't be sure about anything. At last, I realized that the man was talking to me. He asked again, "How do you feel?" "All right," I told him, my voice rough from a dry throat. Suddenly, I remembered everything: the shipwreck, the dinghy, the fight between Helmar and the sailor. Then I started wondering how I had been discovered and where I was. I attempted to put these thoughts into words, but couldn't. However, the man appeared to understand what I was trying to convey. "You were starving when we found you, just skin and bones. The boat you were in was called Lady Vane. There was blood on the gunwale," the man said, helping me to lift myself up as he handed me a small glass of cold, red liquid. "Drink this. You're lucky we found you, a boat with a medical man like me on board. On an ordinary ship, you'd have not lasted long. I've helped you recover. Do your arms hurt? Look, I've given you injections to save your life. That's why you're bruised. I thought you'd die, but you didn't." It was a lot of information to take in. I looked at my skinny arms, filled with needle pricks and covered in. I asked him about the boat and where we were going. "This boat is called the Ipecacuanha. It's a stupid name, as everybody knows, and Captain Davies is an alcoholic. You'll meet him soon. I don't know where the boat is heading, but I'll be getting off on the small island where I live, with my cargo. Anyway, enough for now. Sleep and rest," he directed me, and I lay back into the pillow with exhaustion.